Welcome to the last panel of the day. My name is Ken Bamberger. I'm a professor at the law school at UC Berkeley and a co-director of the Center for Law and Technology. And this last panel is called The Coming Design Wars, Regulation by Technology in Privacy. We are lucky to have with us five terrific panelists to talk about an issue which will actually draw on some of the things that came up but couldn't be discussed in earlier panels that were a little more forward-looking in terms of thinking about the place for debates about values, including privacy, in technology, looking forward. Our first panelist who will make a presentation of the Coming Design Wars project is Deirdre Mulligan, associate professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley, and formerly the founding director of the Samuelson Law and Technology Clinic at Berkeley Law. She's an expert in information privacy and security and in the governance of technology. Particularly relevant for today's discussion, she's the chair of the organizing committee for a series of major workshops that the Computing Community Consortium is holding on privacy by design. She's also chairman of the board of directors of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Second in our panel, Tyler Newby, partner at Fenwick and West, working in privacy and intellectual property. Previously, he was a trial attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice, Criminal Division's Computer Crime and IP section, so brings both the private practice and the government enforcement perspective to our panel. Next on the panel, Rob Sherman, the Deputy Chief Privacy Officer at Facebook, and he's responsible for managing the company's engagement on public policy issues surrounding privacy, security, and online trust. Next, Chris Conley, policy attorney with the Technology and Civil Liberties Project of the ACLU of Northern California. His work has focused on issues of government surveillance, including the role of oversight of law enforcement use of such technologies. Last, Joseph Olideff. Joe is the vice president for global public policy and the chief privacy strategist for Oracle. There, he's in charge of international and internet policy issues, as well as privacy across all Oracle operations. He's also played a prominent role in a number of international organizations dedicated to internet policy, security, and privacy, so brings both of these levels of perspective on questions of where technology values should be discussed. To start the panel, Professor Mulligan will give about a 15-minute discussion of the Coming Design Wars project. Then we'll involve each of our speakers and hopefully progress to a fantastic discussion in which we can involve you as well. So please welcome Professor Deirdre Mulligan.
Thank you, Ken, and I just want to again thank the staff of BCLT, who just does a tremendous job every year and makes it seem like it's so easy for the faculty directors. We're like, oh, look at this lovely thing that appeared. And we know that the amount of work that they put into it makes it so simple for us, and we are deeply, deeply grateful.
Amen.
And I hope you are too. Okay, so the themes that we're going to develop today in this panel have very kindly already been set up for us by some of the questions that have been asked of earlier panelists around the issue of design. The key one earlier was, is there a technical fix for that? And that, in fact, is kind of the question of the hour. It's the question on everyone's lips. The title of the paper, The Coming Design Wars, the title of the project, I realize is somewhat kind of bold and inflammatory, and I think we chose it to be just that, in that what Ken and I see looming on the horizon is something that has historically been a series of skirmishes around things such as export control, which was discussed earlier around encryption, the Clipper chip, more recent or battles over DRM technical standards, battles over whether technical standards OPIS or whether or not the internet should be wiretappable, that have happened in this particular way where we've had a particular well-organized government interest on one side, typically law enforcement and national security, and a pretty diverse set of interests on the other side, not well formulated. So there have been kind of battles and skirmishes that have played out, flared up, and then died down. And today our position is that we're preparing and beginning to see something quite different that is going to culminate either in a war that's not very well organized, or perhaps if we can pull things together, a richer, broader conversation exactly of the sort that Mike Kinsey said Microsoft was trying to trigger in the Microsoft v. Ireland case. So with that, I think I can get this to work. Okay. So we want to say that the governance of the internet is in flux, and we're going to talk about the shifts across three different planes, the objectives. What are the objectives that we're looking for in technical design, the actors, who are we relying on, and finally the venues where these disputes and battles are starting to happen. Whoops, sorry. And in particular, I want to highlight that we see at a kind of meta level a shift from internet governance to governance of the internet, to internet as governance. People literally trying to use the DNS system, as was discussed earlier, technical standard setting bodies, or product design, not just to help implement or to provide hooks for values, but literally to settle them. And this is the shift. So for objectives, typically if you were an engineer, you think about issues of interoperability, we think about issues of efficiency and elegance and innovation. But today, more and more, they're being asked to do things that are about preserving and advancing specific values. Those venues range from standard setting bodies to the internet architecture, so places like ICANN, the DNS system, and right all the way down to product design, where we've seen agencies such as the Federal Trade Commission actually consider the design decisions to be potentially unfair. Actors, as in that shift, the actors who are responsible for values are shifting, and we see the corporate decisions. Danielle Citron was talking earlier about, well, law might only get us so far. Corporations can take us down closer to the problem. Lawyers are really important, but we heard Harvey, we heard Mike, we heard Laura. They were all talking about the fact that, and Harvey, we needed a privacy engineer. We need a different sort of person to help us bring values down that far. And from legislatures to standard-setting bodies to perhaps this war and tussle about exactly where these values should be played out. So I want to talk just a few examples of ways in which we see the responsibility for values being distributed. Some of you may remember the Shitao case and where Yahoo handed over information about a Chinese dissident to the Chinese government and eventually was hauled in before Congress, and Jerry Yang was basically told that, you know, while Silicon Valley, you may be technologically and financially, you are giants, morally you are pygmies, right? And this sense from Congress, and they literally, right, said, Tom Lantos said, if they had come for Anne Frank, would you have said, oh, yeah, well, sure, we'll comply with the law, right? That was his question to them. The idea that they had an obligation in their technical design decisions, in their policies and procedures, not just to comply with whatever local law happened to be, but to actually think about the values that they wanted to reflect and bring out in the world. The Ruggie Report, which some of you may be familiar with, John Ruggie was the special rapporteur on freedom of expression and privacy to the UN, and his report about protect, respect, and remedy framework sets out a new set of responsibilities that cover not just the government's role in human rights, but also what it means for the corporate sector and what their obligations are in the human rights framework. And then activities such as the Global Network Initiative, which some of the large tech companies, along with civil society and investors and academics, formed to create a multi-stakeholder commitment to freedom of expression and privacy on the internet that could be used as a touchstone for guiding everything from market entry decisions to product acquisition, company acquisition, design, policies, and particularly those policies that are about interacting with the government. So these are all about shifting who is responsible for these values. But those values, they are competing. So on the one hand, from the human rights community, whether it's coming out of multi-stakeholder initiatives that are happening through WSIS under the UN or through data protection regulators and privacy regulators, heavy emphasis on anonymity as an essential building block of an internet that is going to promote privacy and freedom of expression and security. An enormous emphasis on privacy by design, by default, by deployment, the same sort of rhetoric we've been used to hearing about with security. On the other hand, we're hearing about going dark, right? And we have national security and law enforcement issues on the other side. And as they've gotten exhausted with their inability to win some of those battles legally, we've seen, and this has also happened historically, I think Jim didn't talk about the part of the kind of CALEA battle where law enforcement went and tried to stack the USTA, which is the Telecommunications Standard Setting Association. So this has happened historically too. But we see them playing dirty, right? And we know that the NSA went after crypto standards, and we know that they hacked into corporate back-end systems. So using technical systems to advance a particular value in a way that is skirting perhaps some of the legal requirements. So we've seen this new alignment of actors and a new battlefield, right? It is not just Congress. It is not just policy-making entities at the international level. It is, in fact, ICANN. It is the DNS system. It is the IET, the Internet Engineering Technical, right? The IETF. It is the W3C. Values are being kind of spread thin and sometimes really thick in these places where we don't traditionally think about them being played out. I want to give you, two examples. One is on the privacy side, right, on this new alignment, we now have not just law enforcement and national security concerned about strong crypto. We have regulators, government actors, right? The government is on both sides of this debate. They're now pushing for privacy by design, including ubiquitous encryption. Second example, the SOPA debate as it played out here in the U.S. was particularly interesting in that part of what was going to be leveraged to advance the interests of protecting copyrights was the DNS system, right? And as that began to come to a head and there was a realization that there was a tension between security and copyright, again, we saw stakeholders within the government align on different sides of that use of the technical infrastructure. All of these instances, people are seeking not just to influence the policy, but they're actually seeking to influence the design of technical standards, the use of the internet architecture, and the design, deployment, and defaults of products. So standard-setting bodies, I want to talk about the two of them quickly. The IETF, if you want to influence technical design, well, where do you go? The Internet Engineering Task Force, they historically have tried not to do policy, right? They say, look, we're in the mechanism design business. We're going to leave policy at the endpoints, with some exceptions. There's a RFC 1984 where they basically encourage, and I want to focus on this word, encourage policies that allow ready access to uniform, strong cryptographic technology. I'm good. So it was an encouraging, they weren't trying to settle the score or weigh in heavily in favor of one value or another at the technical level, but they were encouraging, as experts in the area, arguments in two other, the most important one being the RFC 2804, where the IETF basically said that they would not design standards to facilitate wiretapping. Doesn't mean that you can't do it, but they were not intentionally going to design things to be wiretappable. The World Wide Web Consortium, which is a layer up, right at the application layer, and there they actually have had a slightly more affirmative, values-oriented engagement with the policy sphere. They have one section of the Worldwide Web Consortium, which is called the Technology and Domain Society, where they have over years now, starting with the Platform for Internet Content Selection, which was an effort to create and facilitate individual empowerment over content that would be coming into the home by enabling a very flexible, distributed, multiple rating system or more descriptive system about content, not rating, but descriptive, to the Platform for Privacy Preferences, which was an effort to make machine-readable statements about privacy available so that your user agent, which you know as your browser, could make decisions on your behalf and to take some of the burden off of users, to more recently the Do Not Track Working Group, which was an effort to try to allow individuals to signal their preference not to be tracked for the purposes of behavioral advertising. Even there, though, I just want to say all of these efforts were designed to create hooks for policy battles that were happening above, not to settle policy, to enable, but not to dictate. Today, standard-setting bodies are owning values. I want to give, they're perceiving more and more the government as adversary. They are responding to attacks on technical standards. I cannot tell you how angry the body of the Internet Engineering Technology, the IETF, was about the NSA attack on crypto standards. They were irate. And they are very affirmatively picking sides. And this is both technologists within companies, who I think are feeling more empowered, as well as technologists within standard-setting bodies. These are two examples. So RFC 6973 at the IETF is privacy considerations for internet protocols. And literally, these are a set of privacy considerations that should be taken into account when you are designing a technical standard. They're bringing privacy into engineering work. They're not viewing it as something that the lawyers deal with. The next one, RFC 7258, basically says pervasive monitoring, as in dragnet analysis of metadata and collection of metadata, is an attack. So if we look out and we say we have clashes of values, and the question is how, if we're going to have a rational conversation about what technology should be used for, which values should it advance, we need to have some efforts to prioritize and pick among those values, and I wanted to identify a few efforts where people are trying to do that. So these are the OECD principles on internet policymaking, which were developed, I want to say, 2 years ago now. And these are the values that they've prioritized for individuals and society: freedom of expression, privacy, security, individual empowerment, creativity and innovation, limited internet intermediary liability, for the network, openness and interoperability, growth and connectivity, for the policy process, open, participatory, self-governance, multi-stakeholderism, you could read into there, procedural fairness, transparency, fair process, and accountability. So these are the sorts of values that are being articulated. Within the context of the human rights conversation, right now the Special Rapporteur on the Protection and Promotion of the Right to freedom of Expression and Privacy is looking at the role of encryption in freedom of expression, and I think, again, signaling that there is some prioritization of values occurring. And within technical standard-setting bodies, we can see from their work there where there are divergent requirements, security is their privileged value, and I would say right after that comes privacy, and we can see that in their rejection of making things wiretappable. And in SOPA, I believe we could see some of that. So I wanted to, given that I only have a minute left, just end with this last slide. Here we go. Thinking about using the internet to govern, right? Governance through the internet invites a set of questions, some of which have been identified before, but I think right now require a deeper reflection. Governance through technology feels very different and is experienced very differently than governance through law. It is borderless, it can be seamless, it can be invisible. It can lose some of the moral weight, right, when all of a sudden things, it's not a moral decision, it's not a legal decision, it's just the way the world is. It becomes something that just isn't possible. Larry Lessig pointed out the level of misdirection it invites. As governments act through infrastructure, all of a sudden they may be able to do things that they were not able to do through law. And perhaps, most importantly, private governance precludes some of the public battles about what government objectives we want to prioritize. And then finally, it also has some real benefits, right, that it may afford, particularly around an issue of privacy, where being made whole after the fact is exceedingly hard, the ability to use technology to get ex-ante protection seems quite attractive. It's less demanding on the individual, and it can be built out in a way that is quite pervasive. But we have choices to make, and the question is, where do we make these choices?
Thanks, Deirdre. What we're going to do now is enlist the expertise of our other four panelists. And what I'm hoping is that, given the questions that Deirdre has put on the table, you might each take about 5 minutes. And from your viewpoint, from your perspective or perspectives, put on the table examples that you see of where values are coming or going to come into conflict, where the design wars might arise, and then if you have thoughts on where some of the interventions might take place, where might the policy discussions, the value discussions, better happen, who should be involved from the domestic side, from the international side. So first we'll turn to Tyler. Thanks.
Sure, thanks. So I have... A little bit probably of a unique perspective among this panel because I'm the only person, I believe, on this panel who has worked on executing search warrants on email accounts, web servers, people's computers in their homes, and have benefited from the output of a wiretap in criminal prosecutions. And so that's not my job now. I'm an advisor and a litigator for technology companies here in the area, but I thought it would be useful, at least for this panel, for me to offer a perspective from, although I don't work for the government now, but to offer more of the government perspective. And I wanted to really draw back on some of the discussion from the last panel, which touched on these issues of design and encryption. I think we're all aware that in the last several months, Apple announced with iOS 8 that there would be encryption by default on all files on iOS devices, and that Apple would no longer have the ability to assist law enforcement with the ability to decrypt those or unlock a password on an iPhone and access those files. And Google has made similar statements with respect to devices running Android. That, of course, has resulted in quite the backlash from law enforcement, with Jim Comey making statements that this is going to frustrate law enforcement's purpose, and it no doubt will. I would say in a number of my cases when I was a prosecutor, I did benefit from the ability to get data off of smartphones and off of people's computers and off of servers. And so I think, you know, there is the big question I think we have to confront is where are the right value, you know, what is the correct value decision on where do we value the ability of law enforcement to investigate and prosecute crimes that in every case, not just cyber cases and hacking cases, but in just about every kind of case now, relies on the use of evidence collected from email accounts and off of phones, whether it's a stalking case or a drug trafficking case, a murder for hire case. It all relies on that evidence. And if as a society we decide the privacy of individuals from prying eyes like intelligence agencies or law enforcement investigators who are going beyond what the law has allowed them to do, in the past, that requires us to shift the value more to protecting the privacy of the individual and prohibiting law enforcement from, even when they have the legal means through a search warrant based on probable cause to get access to that data, is it more important to protect people's privacy than it is to allow law enforcement to investigate and prosecute crimes? And you know, as Will said from the last panel, it's a really hard question, and I don't think there's an easy answer. I do think, you know, where we are right now is very much a product of what has happened in the last year to 2 years with Edward Snowden revelations. And we've lost our trust in law enforcement and intelligence to act within the law as it exists. And so we can't just say we assume that law enforcement will correctly use search warrant powers, that they won't abuse national security letters, that they won't abuse the pen registered trap and trace laws to collect metadata on every single phone call and internet communication in the United States of every single person. And I think that has shifted the discussion more in favor of the pro-privacy. And I wonder, is that discussion going to shift again if we have another major incident like a major terrorist attack or some horrible crime, and it was the ability of law enforcement or intelligence agencies to prevent it was frustrated because they couldn't get access to that data? So I think that's, you know, one of the big issues of the day on whether there should be and will be laws requiring, for example, the ability of internet communication service provider to decrypt data of their users, and who should be responsible for making that decisions. Is it the Congress? Is it FCC through rulemaking procedures? Or should it be the companies themselves?
So we have one really hard value question on the table already. Rob, are there others that strike you that are key in this design war landscape?
Sure. I mean, I think when we look at the concept of design wars and looking forward, the thing that I take away from that is that there's this connection between policy and technology, that they influence one another, and that we need to be aware of the ways in which they do. And I think, Tyler, the example that you give about government access to data is a really important one. At Facebook, and I'll have maybe one other gloss on that, which is, at Facebook, we spend a lot of time scrutinizing government requests and making sure that when we're giving data, it's in a lawful and appropriate way, and when we push back, where it's appropriate. But we also spend a lot of time on the technology side of that, on encrypting communications between us and our users, and making sure that we protect the information that we're storing as well. And the goal there is to make sure, essentially, the way I think about it is making sure that the data, if it's going out, is going out the front door in an appropriate and transparent way, not going out the back door. That's a case where, you know, the focus has shifted in some sense from policy to technology, and where technological limitations can influence the place where we have those debates, and make sure we're having them in the open, and make sure people understand what the values at stake are, and that we can have a discussion about them. I also think there's a risk of disputes over technology driving policy too much, or disputes over policy driving technology too much, and some examples of sort of where these things show up. So one is maybe a Facebook-specific example, just since that's where I work and that's what I think about a lot. I think you see companies' perspectives on policy reflected in very significant ways in the technological design decisions that they make. And so one example of that is that Facebook, we say our mission is to help make the world more open and connected, and we help people share with the people they want in the ways that they want in order to do that. And so when you use Facebook, the design of the service is meant to implement that policy decision. The design is meant to implement, you know, when you post something, we ask you right there who should see this, and you get to choose who will see that. When you use an app, What information should that app get? And so there's a real effort contextually to provide those choices. Other companies have different values. They implement that differently, and law actually implements it very differently. So if you look at different laws that govern data protection, some are much more about empowering people to make the choices that are right for them. Some are much more about saying, here's a baseline that everybody should adhere to. And those decisions happen in the context of technological design. Another example of this is of technology getting in the way of policy, maybe, or policy getting in the way of technology, is platform change. So if you think about mobile devices, right? So I have an iPhone in my pocket. 10 years ago, if we would have asked what the mobile landscape would have looked like in 2015, I think we probably would have all had a really strong guess and very strong convictions as we sat up here on this panel about what the mobile landscape would look like. We probably would have all been wrong. And so one of the challenges that we have in 2015 is figuring out, as we've made policy pronouncements that are very technology specific, that say, okay, this technology that existed in the year 2000 or whatever year we're looking at, this is the rule that applies to that technology. So now we have a different platform, and we have to figure out how does that work. And so we then stop having the discussions about policy and start having, okay, we had this old policy that doesn't really work in this context. How do we think about privacy policies on a mobile screen, or how do we make disclosures, or these kinds of things? And so what that tells me is one of the places where we have to be careful in looking at the design wars and sort of the interplay between policy and technology is making sure that policy is not trying to drive technology and say this is the one way that we should do things, but instead to focus on at a higher level the kinds of behaviors that we think are appropriate, that, and to use your framing, Deirdre, the values that we think are the ones that we should espouse. And I think when you look at making those decisions separately, what are the policies and values that we should espouse, and how should we implement them? The two inform each other, and I think increasingly technology is driving a lot of those decisions. But I think we also have to be mindful of the way that they interplay with one another.
So we have some traditional contexts or fora in which these debates can play out. We have laws, we have regulations. We see that as a matter of practice. Many of those debates between functionality, privacy, are happening within the corporate context. Chris, how does everyone else get in this debate? You know, where can the public get in? Where can interest groups get in? Where can consumers get in?
We find our ways, but I mean, the short answer is that a lot of these design decisions really reflect on one of the key elements that Deirdre mentioned, which is the transparency aspect. And there are two ways you could look at that. One is that design decisions have a real impact on what is communicated to the people who are affected by them. I'll actually take Facebook as an example. A few years ago, Facebook changed the way applications work so that they had to inform a user exactly what information they were seeking. That radically changed the understanding. It didn't actually change what applications could do, but it changed the landscape in terms of communicating to an individual what choices are being made, what information is being shared, and it was a design decision that had a real impact on privacy, and one we applauded. Others we haven't applauded, but that's the nature of the game. There are decisions like that that can push information up and make it more transparent, make these choices more available to the consumer, to the individual, to the voter, to outside entities of all sorts that can empower them. We saw that also as well in cases like SOPA, where SOPA was decided because there was a threat to structure. SOPA was also influenced because the public was engaged, where people, the internet companies that were on previous panels and others, brought in the public and gave them a voice, informed them, this is a decision that's being made that is going to have an impact on your life. And the outcry from that is, politically speaking, I think more important than the technical decision of what the consequence was. The companies decided what they saw as a potential consequence. The voters who called the representatives heard the internet's going to die, and they spoke. But it's definitely a way where technology, where making decisions, bringing them to the public level, has real influences on the way people act. On the other hand, it's very easy to see regulation through technology design hiding the ball, very, very clearly concealing what is going on. We look at things like I mean, there are numerous NSA examples I could pull out, but that's probably the most salient example of ways that design decisions that were perhaps not intended to be vulnerabilities have been exploited. And it's not hard to see, you know, in fact, there are instances of the NSA influence encryption standards where they were intended to be exploited. These kind of decisions where it's actually, as Deirdre mentioned, I think, her last slide, it's not only concealing the intention, the goal from perhaps the consumer, the broad public, but perhaps even from the technical standards themselves, from the people who are making technical decisions who are not clear on what the objective is for a particular proposal, can be deeply problematic. So I think that, you know, the transparency issue is really salient here for a couple of reasons. One is just, you know, the general principle of democracy is that if we're making policy decisions, they should be made by the body politic, by the public, and at least having a voice in these decisions. The public are not technical experts. They are not privy to all of the sensitivities of national security that certainly do exist, and you can't broadcast everything to them. But when you're making decisions that have long-term ramifications that can be concealed in technology, that could be dealt away to the Mounties for $10 million, $10,000, whatever it was, but can be, you know, these decisions can be made through soft power that don't have any kind of legislative record. That's really concerning, and that's one of the areas where I think we should focus our attention on. If these kind of decisions are made at the technical level, how can that impact things? The other part of the public policy engagement that's really important is to really thoroughly flesh out some of the trade-offs, some of the consequences, some of the unintended or intended consequences, potentially collateral damage from these design decisions. Because if you have a small group of people, if it's only law enforcement and industry leaders who are having dialogues around should you encrypt, should you open, should you push for this or that design decision that impacts a broader set of issues, you're losing part of the debate. You're losing the real engagement with all parties around how are we going to balance these values? How are we going to understand? And we're also losing the ability to really understand what is and is not feasible. We talk about, you know, the threat of encryption. Well, I can use Gmail to send encrypted information if I add on a layer. I can use Tor to circumvent all sorts of things. There are tools out there. There are technological designs that allow me to essentially layer on my own private infrastructure over someone else's offering. And we would have to think very, very hard and carefully if we were going to press against those, try to limit open source, international, external sources that can provide privacy. And if we don't do that, are we really, as a couple panelists on the previous panel mentioned, achieving our policy objective, or are we simply taking away protections from a common user but still rendering them available to the people who could use them both for harmful purposes? Leave it at that.
So, Joe, privacy by design, are we just hiding the ball? Are we letting the wrong people make the choices and make the balance?
Well, let me first start out by I'll take issue with one of the phrases that Deirdre uses, which was governance as the Internet, because I think the shift that's happened is governance of the Internet to governance on the Internet. And I think that's really the concept. Where I think you are correct, because you said Internet and technology, I think there are some people who look at privacy by design and presume that technology is the silver bullet of privacy by design, and that's where I would disagree, because technology is an element. But privacy by design is people, processes, policy, and technology. You can't do it with any one of those elements. You have to do it across all of those elements, and it has to be coded to the DNA of the company. Because it's not a top-down, I can dictate how you do this. It has to emerge in the company and work within the company's infrastructure and the company's values and the way the company was structured. So I think it's very difficult to then figure out exactly how you take an external pressure on privacy by design, like a government desire to access data, and then implement that into what is a design process that has to be across an entire company, across all of its disciplines, in a way that makes logical sense for the product, for the company, for the users, et cetera. And in some ways, I think it's more than just shifting values. It's the broadening of the ecosystem. So, I mean, now companies no longer can think of them as an organization. They have to think of themselves as a value chain. So it is a large ecosystem. You have to worry about your suppliers. You have to worry about your customers. You have to worry about data flows going through all of those places, how you impact them, how you don't. What's the implication of changes in those data flows? What's the implication of trust related to what you do with data and don't do with data? All of those are part of the elements of consideration. Similarly, I think we have to recall Will's concept that at the end of the day, while companies may be the current battlefield of this issue, the resolution of this issue is an intergovernmental and a societal dialogue. Companies cannot solve this issue even though they're being asked to. And the answer is that we have to come to some semblance where, you know, I think it was 4.5 years ago, there was actually a high-level dialogue between the European Union and the U.S. I think it was Stuart Baker who might have been on one side, and Commissioner Redding's team was on the other side, and they actually came up with something that was a high-level agreement on investigatory principles. And it wasn't sufficiently detailed or binding to be enough for either side, but it was the beginning of that conversation, which somehow has gotten shelved along the way through the various issues that have come up through the Snowden revelations and whatever else has helped to destabilize relationships. But getting those kind of conversations back on track in a meaningful way, getting them to have a discussion then at a societal level when they've figured out what the resolution of the issues is the way that you restore trust. You know, it's not going to be a tremendously beneficial thing to say trust is, trust restored by a mutual arsenal of equally destructive methodologies is not the best way to establish trust. That might be the patch that you have in the short term, but that is not the long-term solution that's going to take us where we need to go. And I would, echo that about 15, 20 years ago, we engaged in this discussion. I think it was around the second RSA conference, if I'm not mistaken. And the kind of finding at that one was it was better to have encryption broadly distributed because that led to a broader level of protection against what was an ever-emerging set of threats. And I think we still have to think about that balance and understand where we are in that space. Because when you undermine the trust in technology by saying, I want to compromise your technology or I don't want your technology to be as good as it could be, that also has a deleterious effect on the way people use technologies. And Will made the other point that, you know, technology companies have to work on the sovereign laws of the countries in which they operate. And when you make one precedent in one country, it's very difficult to tell another country not to follow that precedent. And not all countries share democratic values, so it is something we have to consider.
So what do you folks think about the suggestion that that maybe it's high-level European, U.S. government discussions that are going to frame in a transparent way these debates? Is that really where we're going to get to? Transparency, participation, functionality, balance, outcome? Do we have faith in that?
Intergovernmental? No, I guess I would say one of the most interesting things for me about the Global Network Initiative, voluntary guidelines for freedom of expression and privacy on the Internet, is that typically you have self-regulatory codes of conduct come out of an environment that looks something like this. You have the NGOs upset and the government upset, and industry says, oh, don't worry, we'll do something about this ourselves so that you won't regulate. And what's interesting in the GNI process is that while GNI binds companies to a set of commitments to which they're also audited, it is a very, and full disclosure, I've been a member of the board, I'm now an alternate on the board, and have watched companies go through that audit process, and they are really quite rigorous, that what the companies are basically doing is acting as a check on government commitment to rule of law, right? And that is a really novel way to think about governance. It's exactly in those countries where governance systems are perceived as weak that the corporations, for example, in the Xi Tao case have faced the most pressure. And the complications about, you know, do we go into China or not go into China are in part because questions about their commitments, normative commitments to international human rights, and questions about their rule of law. And so the companies, that self-regulatory piece is a multi-stakeholder effort about civil society and industry and investors coming together to ensure that the human rights implications of platforms, right, the fact that we're disclosing all of our secrets into these platforms that are potentially going to be under great pressure to serve lots of needs. And I love, all right, so the FBI director talked about there should be no lawless sphere. I was kind of like, so I don't know. I don't think I've ever been required to keep all of my records because at some point I might do something wrong. And that's what undergirds that statement, is that somehow or other there should be a time machine that's capturing all of our data and that they can dip back into it sometime in the future when we've done something wrong in the past. And we've never been required to kind of trail around our permanent record. And so it's an interesting kind of like alternative reality, and I think that the GNI sort of thing suggests to me that government negotiations, unless you're thinking about something like a nuclear arms treaty where we all agree that, you know, if we continue forward, we're going to destroy ourselves, right, if everybody engages in bulk collection. Otherwise, I don't really see that that's the answer. I think that multi-stakeholder, you have to include civil society and the corporations and others.
I think the reality of this is that there's not one solution to any of these big problems, and there's not one actor that can solve those problems. And so, I mean, in the government context, you know, Chris said that Facebook and the ACLU have different perspectives on some things. I think we have a pretty similar perspective on that issue.
Yes.
And I think, you know, one of the reasons why we're talking about this topic rather than some other topic at this conference is in part because there was transparency about what was going on. People had an ability to form an opinion. Organizations like the ACLU got involved and expressed a view, and so now we're having discussions that are technological, that are policy-based, and that are values-based about what things should look like. I think, you know, and I think that is just a reflection of the fact that if you want something to get done, if we need to change our perspective or we need to change the way that we operate as a society, we all really need to get together and have a discussion, figure out what the right path is, and move together. And I think the multi-stakeholder dialogues that Deirdre was talking about are another example of that. I mean, I think you see that in the outside of the government context when we look at privacy. You know, we think one of the biggest checks on what we do at Facebook, obviously there are legal checks and policy checks, but one of the biggest checks is just trust. And I think you've heard that a bunch today. And the reason is, you know, we try to be transparent about what we're doing. If we do something that Chris Conley doesn't like, then we will probably all hear about it. And the people that we serve, the people that use Facebook every day, will hear about it too. And they'll be less likely to use Facebook if they don't trust us. And so we have a lot of incentive to make sure that we're doing right by people. But that happens because we're talking about what we're doing, because the government is looking at what we're doing and making sure that we're doing it appropriately, and that NGOs are doing the same thing. I think if you take that concept and think about it more broadly to these policy debates, it's a reflection of that we're not going to solve the big quintessential privacy problems with any one sphere just sort of taking it on and saying, like, this is what we're going to do. We have to have these discussions, and we have to do them deliberately and broadly.
Right, and I think the discussions also benefit from, you know, diverse potential solutions being tested, and that's something that we see in the technology space. I mean, Facebook's concern is that users will go away. It's also that, you know, there are other companies who would love to take those users, and if they're offering a different product, they can, you know, conceivably switch. It's not easy, but it's possible. Whereas, you know, and that's one of the concerns about regulating through design, is that it takes away the ability for, you know, markets and consumers and others to express preferences and have an ongoing dialogue. If you declare by fiat that something is mandatory or something is prohibited at the design level, you close that debate. And a lot of these discussions are going to evolve because technology is going to evolve. And, you know, the mobile world of 2025 is something that none of us can speculate about either. And we need to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, efforts to strongly regulate ways that technology develops may be ineffective and may alter the course of the way that innovation can take place. And I think that's something that we just need to be aware of, as we're not that these discussions don't have to take place. Maybe one of the benefits of the international space is that it's very, very slow, and it gives time to play out elsewhere. So I might even say that's a good thing in this situation, in that it does give us time to evaluate where technology can take us in an open way rather than in a directed way.
Look, I think, you know, part of what I said was that the intergovernmental conversation has to result in a societal one as well. You can't have one without the other. But the reality is that in the intergovernmental space, we now have the European draft regulation essentially suggesting that if you receive a request from a law enforcement authority that isn't European, you have to provide them notice regardless of whether or not that notice is permissible to be provided. It by default suggests that every European intelligence authority is trustworthy and has never acted in any way but the good way. And, you know, I think we have to get into that conversation where you start talking about some of these lawful intercept decisions and agreements and figure out how this stuff actually works. One of the things that was said on the previous panel, which is absolutely correct, is the MLATs are no longer able to do what they were supposed to do because they've become too cumbersome, they take too long, they don't operate in the real time where these things have to be resolved. And so, you know, through the International Chamber of Commerce and other business associations, we're working to propose suggestions on, hey, you have to start to improve these MLATs and figure out how to make these solutions workable. Because at the end of the day, the societal dialogue, as we all know, takes quite a while before it can take hold. We're not always exactly sure who needs to participate in it and how it organizes itself. And in some cases, when national security is at issue, governments don't always pay attention to the societal dialogue. So the question becomes, we have a set of issues which become practical hurdles to the way in which we live, which we need to figure out how to resolve. And I think, you know, getting the governments to talk about that narrow set of disagreements on the way they use these processes is an essential first step, because some practical solutions have to get put in place. Otherwise, we're just going to see these roadblocks all over the place, which aren't going to be good for companies, aren't going to be good for individuals, and in the long run, aren't good for governments either. So, you know, I do think we have to start somewhere, and, you know, the intergovernmental dialogue seems to be part of that. But I think the intergovernmental dialogue doesn't address the values issues. It addresses practical process issues on how you get beyond where we are now.
Stepping back a little bit from these higher kind of higher level issues of government surveillance, I think there's also a place just for companies responding through competition without going through standard setting bodies and without looking to guidance from government agencies or rulemaking processes to respond to changing consumer values on privacy. And I think one great example of that is the way that, if you look at the ways that Google through Android and Apple through its iOS have changed or dealt with ways of providing notice to users of how they collect data. And we've seen with Apple, for example, or with Android, and I'm just speaking as an observer, not as an attorney for these companies, with Android providing notice through when you first install an app of all of the different types of information that the app collects, and then Apple taking a completely different methodology, in which they've adjusted over time, of notifying you just in time if an app is going to collect your contact information after the dust up or contact uploads a couple of years ago, or your location information, or accessing your photos. And that all developed, you know, through these companies responding to consumers expressing concern, and it happened without government rulemaking or legislation, and it happened naturally through the competitive process, I think much more or much faster than it would have through some kind of standard-setting body. So I think that's a very valuable process of setting design, privacy by design, that shouldn't be ignored.
Anyone want to respond to that? Or?
Sure, I'll respond. I mean, I think I agree a lot with what Tyler said. I think one of the constituencies that, as I've been listening to all of us talking about this issue, that seems missing is people, right? So we talk about, you know, multi-stakeholder processes and companies, what should they do and what should the governments do. And I think it's actually really important for us to take a step back and realize, I mean, if I were to look at one of the trends, you know, as we look down the road, one of the trends that I see is that privacy is becoming more complicated. And what I mean by that is not everybody isn't meaning the same thing when they say privacy. It's no longer like I go to my bank and I want my bank account to be secret, right? I don't want the bank to tell people who I'm spending my money with, which obviously I still have that preference. But I use Facebook, and I don't want everything to be secret. I'm on Facebook to share, but I'm obviously not on Facebook to share everything with everybody. And so people's preferences about what they're comfortable sharing with who are going to become more complicated, and they're going to become more complicated as we have new services and new technologies and new businesses. And so I actually think that where Tyler ended that discussion is maybe where we should start, which is how do we empower people to make the choices that are right for them? And, you know, and how can people in the choices of the products and services that they use drive the innovation in that area?
I do the particularly notions of privacy that are coming to light in social networks in particular, I think are far more complicated. Historically, we've thought about privacy between the individual and the government or the individual and the company, and we've been very focused on this data protection, fair information practices sort of model. And when we're thinking about platforms that are hosting interactions between individuals, the sort of privacy issues that Danielle was raising in her talk, right, where one individual is disclosing another individual's secrets, mm-hmm. private moments, sex acts, whatever. The emotional contagion study is a great example where I'm sure you're all familiar with that. What was so interesting there is that there were some individuals who I think were concerned that they were being represented to other people as more depressed than they were, right, that they were being portrayed in perhaps a false light. And there were other individuals who were feeling like their autonomy, their decision-making was being interfered with because they were being seeded intentionally with things that were designed to manipulate their emotional state. And then there were some individuals who were concerned about the fact that they were leaking information, that you're testing me to see whether or not I'm manipulable, right? And so I'm actually, you're collecting new information that you didn't have before on me. And none of those fit into the notice and consent model, right? But they all reflect different concepts of privacy that are, we can see throughout privacy law very well. But it suggests a whole bunch of different issues if we're thinking about privacy by design. It's not about notice and consent. It's about a much richer, thicker, deeper understanding of privacy.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck, Deirdre, when you put up your slide and you had P3P listed up on the slide, and I was thinking back to the days of P3P and EPAL. And back then, the complexity of privacy overwhelmed those solutions because we couldn't map to the granularity. And if we think of back then, those were the good old days when things weren't actually complex yet at all. And we couldn't figure out how to map them then. And so, you know, we're sitting in a situation where you also have a range of personal preferences, the people who want to disclose a lot of information about themselves and who may care less about some of the consequences related to that versus the people who we would put in the Alan Weston privacy fundamentalist group. And so I think that subjective nature of privacy has gotten perhaps even more subjective than the days of EPAL, and trying to figure out how to respect that person's ability to make their own choices is tremendously important. And, you know, the thing with privacy by design, it's a framework that enables the person to participate in a way that is meaningful for them yet respectful of them, versus a top-down system that dictates the way everyone's going to participate in the system. And that's what makes it difficult to architect, because you have to architect it down to that person's choices in a framework concept and not in everybody must want the same thing you want and here's the set of choices you have, because that's not, you know, that's not what the subjective nature of privacy unfortunately is. It would be a much more easy technical solution if it was. And so I think that's the challenge we're facing in privacy by design, and things like the principles that Kim Cameron and Ann Kubukin had come up with, you know, are useful ways to start. Some of the Canadian papers that put out frameworks for privacy management programs are useful. But I think we're still in kind of that learning curve on some of these privacy by design issues, and, you know, what we're talking about here is some of the external pressures that exist in the privacy by design world as well. And I think this is a very kind of, this is an inflection point perhaps, because this is where privacy by design has hit its first set of real growing pains. And I think we're trying to figure out how to grow through them. And I think the dialogue is tremendously important in understanding how to, I think that concept of how to get people involved in the dialogue as opposed to just representatives of people to get involved in the dialogue is really important.
I think it also especially underscores the point you made earlier, and we were talking about a little yesterday, about the timing of these kind of discussions. Once you've said to someone, okay, design this, it's almost too late, because then they'll go out and start designing, and the prior conversation didn't happen. So how can we push those conversations back into a place where we can get the inputs we want before the design, before the coding, before the process actually begins?
Only to be complicated by the fact that privacy isn't the only value we want to design for.
Correct.
Right. It turns out.
On that note, maybe I will open up to the floor and see if any folks have questions that they want to throw out, and the panel can move forward with those.
It is on. The risk of putting everyone to sleep at the end of a long day. I'm going to be a cynic here. I'm hearing all this discussion about values and about giving people choices and about designing things so those choices can be implemented. And I'm thinking in my own head, this is really about power. Different levels of interactions between different players where there's a total lack of power, or a pretty serious lack of power on one side of the interaction and almost complete power on the other. You talk about the way Android approached some privacy issues versus the way that Apple approached some privacy issues. Okay, as a consumer, my real power is to pick one of those two. All right, that's better than nothing. You talk about companies needing to do business or wanting to do business in China or wanting to do business in the EU. Well, ultimately, the EU is going to set its rules. Ultimately, China is going to set its rules, which currently look like they're going to want things like source code and other things. And where's the power? Well, if I want to do business in China, power's on the side of China. If I want to do business in the EU, well, then I've got to deal with things like the right to forget. If I want to do business in the United States, I've got to do business in a political context where the Congress and the President can barely agree on what time of day it is. So I hear all this, and it's great, and I think it's important. I think discussions like this and groups like the ACLU and companies like Facebook and Microsoft and the others represented today, here today, have their own ability to impact the debate and to shape the debate. But I haven't heard anything today about, hey, let's be realistic about this. There's a series of power battles going on. I'll admit I'm being cynical. I'm a little tired, a little cranky. But that you know, it just feels unreal to me.
It's the perfect time of day for this panel.
A few years ago, maybe 5 years ago now, Jeff Rosen wrote a piece for the New York Times in which he called Nicole Wong, who just recently left the White House, the decider. Right? She was at Google at the time, and she was the person who was sent out to, you know, negotiate with the Thai president, the Thai government, right, about whether or not they were going to take down certain videos or those sorts of like complicated questions. And I think that I'm always an optimist, and I don't know that I'm optimistic. Well, I think at a real level, yes, this is about power. However, I think you're underestimating the extent to which some of the large platforms today do have power. And I think you could look at something like the right to be forgotten, which sure, court decision, and basically the entire decision about how to implement has been left with some guidance from the data protection, you know, the data protection authorities through the Article 29 working group to Google and Yahoo, and right, that an enormous divestment of responsibility over huge policy decisions have been handed off, right? That's governance for you. And so I think that you may be being cynical, but I think that you might not be being realistic, that power has always been shared, and I would say today their power is even more shared.
I don't think it's shared at all. But I think there are a series of discrete battles where you can predict how the battle is going to come out, not by the quality of the advocacy or the values that are being forwarded, but by the relative power.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think back to the second RSA conference, the clipper chip was the big talk then. And if you had bet against the clipper chip at the beginning of that conference, everyone would have said you were crazy. But by the time the third conference rolled around, the clipper chip was in real trouble, if not history. And that was a confluence of technical arguments, industry arguments, civil society arguments. So I agree with you that the real politic out there exists. and we all have to deal with it in one way or another, and it's an uphill slog to change any of those things. But a coordinated effort does sometimes make a dent in it. It's not 100% by any stretch of the imagination, but there are opportunities to make those changes at the policy level, and what you have to do is find out, you know, it was considered at the end of the day that that didn't work in the national self-interest, but it took a lot of convincing to make that argument stick. And I think we're in the place where it's going to take a lot of convincing to make any of these arguments stick. And the arguments are not going to be the same across geographies. You're absolutely right about that.
I have two questions. Thanks for an excellent panel. The first deals with security as a privileged value. Deirdre, you've talked about this idea of security being a privileged value. I wanted to invite you to talk about a little bit more about what that means. But also I wanted to invite the panel to discuss what it means that the Internet of Things report led with security. And so, look, so what values will we see in the Internet of Things as a result of that recommendation? And the second is somewhat of an observation. It is very popular in tech punditry to hear the idea that technology is neutral. And even if you read Eric Schmidt's recent book, he explicitly says technology is neutral. This whole panel, though, seems not to hold that assumption. And I wonder if one way to explain your narrative is that the technologists woke up to this soundbite and realized it was wrong. And they never read Langdon Winner, and they never read Bert Jaap Koops. And they just woke up and said, wait a minute, there's all sorts of value in our design. We weren't willing to acknowledge it earlier, and now we're going to jump in.
So I think that the technologists have been quite aware of the power of technical standards and the power of technical design for quite some time. And in many ways, so you could look, you know, there's a very famous article, at least in my circles, about tussles in cyberspace by Dave Clark and several other authors that basically identify the extent to which using things like Winner and Bruno Latour and others to explain that they have kind of a privileged position in society and that they're building the playing field upon which all of these battles are going to play out. And so, you know, where they put the speed bumps and where they put the switches really matter. And so I don't think that they've been ignorant of the fact that they have that power. I think that they have tried to exercise great restraint and to say, we actually want to build things that are flexible and work to support lots of different things. And, you know, people associate this with the end-to-end principle of the Internet, that we're going to try to just, you know, move the packets around and allow people to have different sorts of applications and make different sorts of policy decisions at the endpoints. But security has been a privileged value in that, in technical circles. And I think part of it is that security can protect privacy, it can protect intellectual property, it can protect physical assets, it can protect lots of different stuff. So security at some level can be viewed as mechanistic. And I think also it's hard to say, oh, no, we want insecurity, right? Like, what's the opposite of that? And so in the conversation about security or cybersecurity, the most important question that people hardly ever ask is securing what? Against who? At what cost to other values, right? And I like to use the example of Sony's DRM'd CDs from many years ago where they put them out into the marketplace and they had put DRM wrappers around them, and when you put them in your machine, they phoned home and installed a rootkit on your machine to secure their intellectual property. That was like their security. And unfortunately, it wasn't really good for your security, right? It leaked out your personal information, and it actually allowed your machine to become part of a DDoS attack on other people's machines. So it wasn't really good for public security, but it was really darn good for Sony from their perspective when they did it. And so security is a privileged value, and because it can be viewed almost mechanistically, and the real important question is to ask about what security is going to protect and who is it going to protect and which values we're going to use it to advance.
I'm not going to say what tech companies might be saying in general, but I think for the most part the language was of technology neutrality, and that concept was that we didn't want to see regulation choosing winners and losers in technology. We thought the regulation and the policy should be technology neutral. There was also a desire not to see a particular technology as good or bad, but rather the implementation of that technology as something that would be good or bad. So RFID by itself is neither good nor bad, it just is. How you use it may be good or bad, depending on what it does in terms of value, societal information, or other things. So for us, it wasn't that technology is neutral, but rather the regulatory and policy environment should in fact be technology neutral, and that a technology outside of its implementation is neither good nor bad. You have to wait and see how it's used before you can make that determination.
I might dispute that a little bit, and then I think most technologists think their technology is good. I mean, they're building it for the billions of dollars, but they're also building it because they think it connects people, or it makes puts information at your fingertips, or it, you know, RFID, for example, is, you know, they had an implementation in mind. They would, you know, they think that there are negative ways of using it. There are potential harmful uses. But I don't think they necessarily think, well, it's they even out, or it's agnostic, and then it could be used as a sword or a shield, and I'm just going to wave my hands. I think most people think that I'm building this thing because it is going to benefit the world in some way, and they really espouse that in their mentality. And I think that comes to some of the decision making here, where I think technologists would chafe when they are told that, you know, no, you can't build it the way you want to, and the way you see it as maximizing, you know, some combination of your chance of being a billionaire and your contribution to the world, you're being pushed into a particular route by some external force, whether that's regulation or something else. So I think that's one place where technologists do embody some set of values. I mean, free expression is really an easy one. The internet, it's hard to argue that most network technologies don't enhance people's ability to communicate. They don't have to be used that way, but they enable communication that was not possible before. And I think and privacy is actually more complicated in that technologies are less likely to clearly benefit or harm privacy. But in other situations, and there are some that clearly could, you know, maybe lean towards one or the other. But I think in a lot of ways, technologists do have opinions about how they're making the world a better place, and having dialogues about maybe you're underestimating the consequences and the harmful effects, and your technology is more neutral or even tipped the other way, is a valuable one to have.
I worry that if we pivot too much to talking about technology as reflecting values and this particular, in Joe's framing, you know, this technology is good or bad, you know, we can talk about that, and very often as a society, I think we react to particular technologies that are used in ways that are concerning RFID. Cookies is another one. I mean, Danielle's talk about privacy, and we don't talk about JPEGs as an evil technology because you might use them in ways that are very invasive and very disruptive. We talk about the fact that that particular kind of activity is objectionable and we should prohibit it. And there's a reason for that. There are lots of different ways that you can use technology, and I think if we're trying to get at the bad, whatever we decide is the bad activity, if we're trying to get at it by saying don't use JPEGs, well, they'll use a different kind of technology. That sounds really simple, but actually a lot of the policy debates we have are about different kinds of technology. And so I think it's incumbent on us, and we've talked about a lot of different mechanisms and different venues where those debates happen, but I think it's incumbent on us to think, you know, it's not that distributing revenge porn on social media or through a search engine or through a JPEG or whatever, like it's not the mechanism that is really the problem. It's the behavior, and we need to abstract that discussion out and then figure out how it applies in lots of different contexts.
Well, with that kind of sum up note, it's quite appropriate. We will end this panel, and I want to extend my thanks for a fantastic group bringing together a bunch of different viewpoints on this important issue. Thank you so much. And you are all invited, or I'll let you do the invitation, so let's applaud our panel.
Direction. Everybody who has their computer still open, go to your calendar and mark Friday, March 11th, 2016. We've already reserved the time and the date, and I think the venue. Yes, we've reserved the venue, Friday, March 11th, 2016, for the fifth Privacy Law Forum, Silicon Valley. And meanwhile, we have our reception outside sponsored by Hogan Lovells. So thanks very much to everybody. Thanks to all of our panelists. Have a good weekend.